Thank you, Dean Dietrich, for that very, very warm welcome. It's such an honor to be here to speak with you. I think it is such an honor for exactly the reasons that Dean Dietrich enumerated. The commitments of Phi Beta Kappa, its long and distinguished history, and the elements of intellectual history, reasoning, and priorities that it continues to stand for. Berea College, where I am president, articulates its mission according to 8 great commitments, which have been in place since its founding in 1855 and were first written down in present form as early as 1962. The second of those 8 great commitments reads, to provide an education of high quality with a liberal arts foundation and outlook. That choice might initially seem a little odd when you think about the clientele of students that Berea College has always sought to serve. And that clientele is what is represented in our first great commitment, to provide an educational opportunity primarily for students from Appalachia, black and white, who have great promise and limited economic resources. Today, Berea's students are drawn preferentially from Kentucky and Central and South Appalachia and the necklace of urban areas that surround Appalachia. Accepting only students of limited economic means, or means in practice that our students come from the lowest quartile of the socioeconomic income bracket in the United States. More than half in their family are the first to attend, attend college. 96% are Pell eligible, and we don't charge tuition of any of those students. So a number of questions about Berea College as a liberal arts institution arise. Why should an institution that serves that group of students select the liberal arts as its basic educational framework? What is that approach, and why is it right for young men and women, black and white, way back in 1855? Is it still the best choice? And if so, why? Why not a more vocational approach, or one that focuses on necessary skills for living, like citizenship, financial expertise, legal acumen, using technology, or even fixing things like plumbing and automobiles? So let me illustrate that last point with a brief story. We have a trustee at the college who's an alum and retired after a successful career in business. He grew up in a holler in southern West Virginia on a subsistence farm where, if everyone in the family worked hard and did all the right things around the calendar, from planting a big garden in the spring and summer, to keeping a milk cow and chickens, to butchering the hogs when the autumn had gotten cold enough to preserve the meat, to chopping firewood and putting up lots of canned goods to get through the winter, and to maintaining all of their own machinery, then no one went hungry. I once asked this trustee what his father thought of the fact that he had gone off to college and had those subsequent career successes. The answer was simultaneously amusing and a little sad. The father had been proud that the son wanted to go to college, be the first in the family to do so, but was surprised to discover when the son returned having graduated that he wasn't any more capable at any of those basic life skills, from planting a garden to butchering hogs or to fixing the tractor when it broke. To the father, his son's college experience had seemed pretty much a waste. Of course, the answer to that question also emerges from the story. The man who eventually came to be our trustee took advantage of his liberal arts education to become a very successful executive and raise his 2 sons in a situation of much greater opportunity and comfort than he had experienced as a young man. We don't teach those basic skills and the knowledge base that underlies them because for most living circumstances, the necessary knowledge changes so rapidly that an education that covered those topics would be out of date even before graduation rolled around. The things, for example, that I learned about fixing my first car, a 1968 Datsun 510, were pretty much worthless even just 10 years later, and thankfully, I have never had to learn anything about hog butchery. So to live with technology and the many advices that surround us in this world of the 20th century, we don't need current plumbing, automotive, or technology know-how, but rather, we're better served by the ability to learn new things at a rapid rate. So if education doesn't need to be about fixing things, then how about more job training? Many employers today would like to be able to hire new workers who already have the skills to do the job from day one. And with all the work, resources, and expense of sending your son or daughter to college, most students and their families would like some assurance that they will get good jobs after they graduate. Well, looking around, we know that those jobs change rapidly too, and that that's been a problem in our country for many workers who find their skills no longer of value in the employment marketplace. The liberal arts approach is skill oriented too, but the skills and habits it teaches are more fundamental. The basic elements of reasoning, communication, intellectual history, cultural competency, and the various literacies. A student well equipped with these skills is more ready for change and the nimble adaptation that modern society demands. And in fact, it's been aptly said that a liberal arts education is training for jobs that do not yet exist. If we can make that case, then a liberal arts education is just as relevant for 2015 as it was in 1855. I want to tell another story that I think puts into vivid perspective the value of liberal arts skills. Not everyone has heard of Bethany McLean. In fact, why don't I make this an audience participation moment? How many of you have heard of Bethany McLean? Good, good. So this will be a new story for you. She's one of my heroes. She grew up in Hibbing, Minnesota, which is kind of a remote town, but a great place to be from if you like iron mines. She earned her BA in English and Mathematics at Williams College, a small but pretty well-regarded liberal arts school in Western Massachusetts. After college, she put those degrees to work as an investment banking analyst at Goldman Sachs, and then became a financial journalist, first working at Fortune magazine, and later Vanity Fair. She now also writes for Slate, so if you read Slate, you'll see her column from time to time. But that isn't why Bethany's a hero. She's a hero because she was the investigative journalist who figured out what was happening at Enron and told the world. The Enron debacle stands still as one of the largest cases of financial management and predatory behavior that the country has ever seen. And Bethany's book, The Smartest Guys in the Room was the name, co-authored with Fortune colleague Peter Elkind, exposed the corrupt business practices of Enron and sent Jeffrey Skilling and Kenneth Lay and other Enron executives to lengthy prison terms. The audit firm, Arthur Andersen, which should have detected the irregularities, but unlike Bethany McLean, did not, went bankrupt too. Interviewed herself after the dust settled, Bethany McLean credited the liberal arts education she had received at Williams by saying that her education had, quote, taught me not only how to answer questions, but also how to question answers. How about that? So how should we characterize this approach to higher education? It's important whenever you talk about the liberal arts to dispel the misconceptions surrounding the name, which can be misunderstood to denote a politically liberal education and one that emphasizes the fine arts to the exclusion of other disciplines. Actually, liberal comes from the Latin word liber, meaning free and unrestricted, and it simply means freeing the educated person from constraints, whatever they are. And from that point of view, a better terminology would be the liberating arts rather than the liberal arts. As for arts, the reference is really to the whole constellation of knowledge and practice in connection with a particular subject. Think of book titles like The Art of Marriage or The Art of Innovation. The latter, incidentally, is by Tom Kelly, general manager of the Silicon Valley-based design firm IDEO, it is, famous for leadership in technological thinking. I might as well mention here that Tom Kelly attended a rather well-known residential liberal arts institution a little to the north of here, Oberlin College, where he earned a BA, that is, a Bachelor of Arts, and there's that word, arts again. His was in political science, one of the liberal arts. A liberal arts education equips and frees the student, who not only learns academic skills, but also gains greater scope for developing the values that inform him or her how to live, not just how to make a living. Another inherent strength of a liberal arts education. Isaac Sharpless was a turn of the 20th century president at Haverford College, the liberal arts school that I was privileged to begin my academic career in now a long time ago. And at a commencement address around the turn of the 20th century, he said the following to the graduates, I'm sure. I suggest that you preach truth and do righteousness as you have been taught, whereinsoever that teaching may commend itself to your consciences and your judgments. For your consciences and your judgments we have not sought to bind, and see you to it that no other institution, no political party, no social circle, no religious organization, no pet ambitions put such chains on you as would tempt you to sacrifice one iota of the moral freedom of your consciences or the intellectual freedom of your judgments. A plaque with those words hung on the wall in the faculty meeting room at Haverford, reminding us always there that the freedom we sought for ourselves and for our students through a liberal arts education is for the enhancement of conscience and judgment. And note also the wonderful use of the word whereinsoever. You can talk a lot and not find occasion to use that word. But another misconception is that you have to go to a small residential college to encounter the liberal arts. This is far from the case, as all of you know, if you're associated with this great university. And in fact, almost all of our country's great research universities, including this one, offer a diversity of programs, including rigorous liberal arts study. In fact, I was rather surprised when I came in the building to see the hallmarks of critical thinking on plaques on the sides of the, I think Isaac Sharpless's quote should be up here too. But I can see that critical thinking is happening in this space all the time. But in order to gain the full advantage of the liberal arts approach at a research university, you have to make good choices in what you study. Not everything is about the liberal arts at a place like the University of Louisville. But I think we have also encountered persons who didn't even attend college at all, but succeeded in becoming liberally educated through life experiences and usually an awful lot of reading. Another misconception is that the liberal arts are impractical and useless. This was actually the misconception of that trustee's father from West Virginia. Actually, the liberal arts don't have to be divorced from practical application. And in fact, in my experience as a teacher for many, many years, it's better not to do so. The application of knowledge enriches the learning process and the knowledge itself. We had a president at Berea College by the name of William Goodell Frost at about the same time as Isaac Sharpless was the president at Haverford College. William Goodell Frost was Berea's third president, Frost says in one of his commencement addresses, Berea is an engine of universal civilization. It must carry on many forms of education at once. teaching people how to get a living and then how to live. Berea College stands with a spade and a spelling book in one hand and a telescope and a Greek testament in the other. Obviously, President Frost's picture of a Berea student was definitely a student who was combining the liberal arts learning and the practical applications. Subsequent presidents deepened and extended the commitment of Berea College to the liberal arts. And alongside them, countless students and their labor supervisors have been working to integrate labor and learning, offering a living lesson that the dignity of menial work is in fact liberating. That's our fourth great commitment, by the way. A commitment to labor and the sense that work experience is critical to the higher educational experience. Menial work frees one from a sense of entitlement and self-indulgence, and especially from an inability to appreciate all the work and all the workers that it takes to produce a fair and comfortable life for everyone. Understanding the dignity and utility of labor means, as a former director of human resources at Berea was fond of saying, that you should work like you mean it. And so I borrowed that phrase and that idea and modified it to be appropriate to what we are ultimately about in education, empowering learners to think like you mean it. Finally, there's the misimpression that good jobs are not available to the liberally educated graduate. Just last week, the Wall Street Journal ran a piece by Andrea Fuller with the headline, "Liberal Arts Yield Low Pay." And the subheading, "Fears of Parents Are Confirmed. Students at Research-Based Colleges Make More." I'll leave you to read the article yourself. It appeared on November 4th, if you want to look it up. But I'll say that applying just a little critical intelligence, a liberal arts skill, undermines the conclusions of the article as expressed in those headlines. In fairness to the author, she does report how her salary data, which comes from the recently released college scorecard of the Department of Education, can be critiqued. Still, the headlines make a point that needs to be addressed. And I think about that as follows. You, like me, I'm sure have encountered many successful persons. And if you paid attention to their educational background, you probably noticed that a large number, maybe even a large majority of them, are products of liberal arts education. If I were to research that subject, on the question of the relative career successes of people who have had different sorts of education, I would start from that anecdotal observation of having met an awful lot of successful products of a liberal arts education. I haven't done that research, and I haven't been able to find anyone that has. So I'll use one observation. It has a much smaller N than we need for a good statistical study, but it's an interesting N anyway. It was noted by someone in President Obama's first administration that every single one of his cabinet members, except for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was the recipient of a liberal arts education. I happened to mention that fact at a meeting of Berea College's Board of Trustees, and after the session, one of our trustees came up to me. That man is a graduate of the Naval Academy in Annapolis, and in fact, has chosen to serve on Berea's board because he got a free education at Annapolis, and he thinks that it ought to be possible for other deserving young men and young women to get a free education as well. Anyway, this man, whose name is Scott, noted to me that in fact, the education he received at Annapolis prior to serving in the submarine fleet was in fact very much a liberal arts education. This despite the fact that Annapolis's mission statement isn't based on anything like our eight great commitments. I looked up Annapolis's mission statement. Anyone know what it is? I think when I tell it to you, you'll say, that's a good choice for Annapolis. It is to train young men and women to fight at sea. I think they got it right. They nailed it, right? So we can think of that as their first grade commitment. And then it's kind of pleasing that their second grade commitment is to the liberal arts approach, just as it is for Berea College. In fact, thinking about it, that's the sort of education I actually want for our country's military leadership. We are going to need a military, but a liberal arts education will make a difference, I'm sure. So anyway, that story indicates that for that group of very successful people, the people that Barack Obama chose to be his cabinet, all 13 of them, I think it was, were products of the liberal arts and of a liberal arts education, as of course is President Obama himself, who went to Harvard. One of the difficulties of talking about the liberal arts is that you spend so much time and effort explaining what they aren't and the various misconceptions about them that it takes a while to get to what they really are. In fact, as a result, several commentators have suggested changing the terminology. I already mentioned the liberating arts, and it has also been suggested that it'd be less confusing to call them the liberal arts learning for careers and life, perhaps. For me, however, that sort of move feels like marketing, and so it kind of runs against the grain of the liberal arts. The liberal arts are about effective communication, but they're not about manipulating impressions as a shortcut to understanding something. So I'm not going to try to change the terminology. But anyway, the need to do all that explaining makes it hard to get around to saying what actually constitutes a liberal arts education. And after all these other considerations, here's my own personal characterization. And this comes, as you noted from the introduction, from a liberally educated person who was an undergraduate double major in math and physics and then went on to a PhD in physics. The liberal arts comprised the curriculum at early European universities where students studied just seven subjects: grammar, logic, rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Nowadays, we have a somewhat longer list of disciplines, but you can see the origins of those disciplines in what those early European students were studying. Rhetoric and grammar have become the liberal arts. Reading, writing, and all the communication skills, the appreciation of graceful and meaningful ways that human beings have found to express themselves in writing and speech. And I think of literature as invention of meaning. Being a scientist, of course, I'm about inventing explanations for natural phenomena, accounts of them. And I think that a gracefully written poem or a new idea that emerges in a well-written essay is just simply another way of creating, a human being creating something, in this case, meaning that helps us all think about the world. And rather than everything being in Latin and Greek, we have a wealth of modern languages to study. And that in turn helps us to understand differences in culture and thought. That reminds me of one of my favorite jokes, and I think this one actually has some sort of a foundation in something that actually happened. It concerns an American classicist who was visiting Rome for a conference. Having gotten lost, he needed help, but didn't speak Italian. So, using Latin, he asked a passerby for directions. The person responded in good English, "You haven't been here in a while, have you?" Speaking other languages and spending time in other countries and cultures gives first and foremost an experience of difference. How people of a different culture think about something is revealed in their language. And of course, it's revealed even more in how they choose to live. I've been fortunate as an academic to spend a substantial amount of time living in other countries, particularly Germany, and every time I do that, I feel like I understand things in a broader kind of way. And of course, particularly for a young person, that fosters the ability to work with people whose perspectives are very different from your own. Logic and geometry have become courses that lead to thinking skills, critical thinking, we like to call it, and that's really what you see delineated up here. There's a little pamphlet, and I've run across it too, that takes that word critical thinking and unpacks it into the specific skills, reasoning skills, that comprise it, and there they are, written on that poster up there. It's the ability to formulate and critically examine arguments and proof. Arithmetic has become quantitative literacy, the ability to analyze information from a numerical point of view. And my skills in arithmetic are something that I probably encountered already well before college, but they are a tremendous help even to the activities of a president. I don't know why the study of the arts in early European education was limited to music, because in classical times, some of the other arts were already well established, but I'm pleased, at least from the start, that we recognize the significance of art education in the liberal arts, and that's something that our culture is in danger of losing, although certainly there's no danger that we will run out of interest among young people in the arts. And finally, there are all the amazing sciences. Only astronomy was sufficiently advanced to reward serious study in the Middle Ages. But since then, along have come physics, biology, chemistry, and the social, personal, and political sciences, with all they tell us about the sensibility and predictability of phenomena of the natural world, and about humans as individuals or in groups. Astronomy is still first among these disciplines for me. I'm a runner, and when I came to Berea a little over 3 years ago, I organized a running group inviting students to run with me. The first thing I discovered, by the way, when you admit students who have no money, they also don't have any running shoes. So that first year, I wound up on many, many trips to Kohl's department store and wound up buying 60 pairs of running shoes. And that actually turns out to be about the most fun thing I do during the year. It's like Christmas in September. But anyway, with this group of students, we now meet a couple mornings a week at 7 a.m. It has to be early because the students are either going to be going to their labor assignments or class by 8 o'clock. And at this time of the year, at least in our part of the state, it's still dark at 7 a.m. And so we've been watching the dance of Venus, Jupiter, and Mars in the eastern sky. They've been exchanging positions. There was a very close conjunction a couple of weeks ago. And seeing those distant worlds still executing those ancient cycles is somehow so moving, both to students, but even to me. I've been watching the stars for at least 40 years now. I didn't pay much attention as a kid myself. Growing up in Southern California, we could barely see through the smog. But obviously, seeing those planets moving without the slightest bit of interest in human affairs puts us in perspective. Of course, then you can open the comic pages and see that, in fact, the planets are influencing us here on Earth. But scientific literacy also underlies the ability of educated people to take on complex challenges, the ones that result from too many of us trying to live in this small planet together, and then to understand and critique what others are doing from the point of view of scientific impacts. In all of this, one can learn to love learning and the free exchange of ideas for both their utility and their intrinsic value. At our institutions, University of Louisville and Berea College, we can be about the exploration of the liberal arts and thus join a guild of freed to be responsible thinkers. Persons who take the love of learning as a guide for life. People who think like they mean it. and people who know how to get a living and then how to live. So thanks so much for your kind attention. I knew that I was going to be addressing the choir, so to speak, and I thought, why not save some time to let you share your perspectives on the liberal arts with one another and with me in response to some of these things that I've said. I will tell you one more story that I think illustrates how the liberal arts support one another. This is something that stems from my days as a teacher of physics, and I always liked to teach some of the history of the discipline as much as I could. And so I would tell the students how Galileo came to the idea that all things, regardless of their weight, fall at the same speed. And we, of course, all know the legend that he went up the Leaning Tower of Pisa and dropped some things, and they fell virtually at the same speed. Not quite, because of air resistance. But Galileo didn't actually figure that out by doing the experiment. He figured that out by logic. Does anybody know this story? He went at it this way. He said, imagine that you have a cannonball and a musket ball. According to Aristotle, when you drop the cannonball and the musket ball from the Leaning Tower of Pisa, the cannonball should fall much faster because it's way heavier than the musket ball. So now imagine, stick them together. Cannonball will want to fall fast. The musket ball will want to fall more slowly. So the tension between the two should result in the combination of the two objects falling slower than a musket, slower than a cannonball, but faster than a musket ball. Good logic, right? But on the other hand, that combined object that consists of the cannonball and the musket ball is actually heavier than a cannonball, so it should actually fall faster than the cannonball. So Galileo had found a logical contradiction in the idea that a heavier thing must necessarily fall faster than a lighter thing. And Galileo actually came to many of his conclusions by that kind of reasoning and then verified them by observation. So he was the last philosopher, becoming the first scientist, and after Galileo, of course, people were putting the observation ahead of the logical reasoning. But I think that's a beautiful way that logic, one of the seven fundamental liberal arts, supports the sciences. And it does so still, of course, that there's an awful lot of logic built into the sciences. So let me pause for your reactions. And I don't know if you speak up, if everyone will be able to hear you. If not, I think I have another microphone here. In the back. That's a great question. Thanks, Tara. We have eight great commitments, and I only told you about a couple of them. Our fifth great commitment is to interracial education, and our sixth great commitment is to co-education in the context of a democratic style of community. And those commitments are there because our founder was an abolitionist preacher who realized before the Civil War that if somebody managed to escape slavery, they still weren't going to have any kind of life if they couldn't get an education. So from the start, Berea College was striving to be an interracial community offering an interracial educational experience. And for the last, the Civil War, of course, messed everything up in our part of the state. And so the college closed for a couple of years. The founder had to escape across the Ohio River, came back after the war. He actually served at Camp Nelson on the Kentucky River as a chaplain to the regiments of Negro soldiers that were being organized. They were mostly escaped slaves, and the Union Army was training them. Not treating them very well either. That's a pretty sad story. But our founder worked, and in fact, after the end of the Civil War, he encouraged many of the men that he had gotten to know at Camp Nelson to come to Berea College, so that for the second half of the 19th century, we were roughly 50-50 black and white. And the founder, his name is Reverend John G. Fee, also wanted the community of Berea itself to be interracial. So he offered plots of land to people who wanted to settle in the town, and he would consciously intersperse people so that if a white family got this plot of land, then an African-American family would get the next plot, and then white family again. And if you look at the streets in the heart of our town, you can still see the remnants of that, because the white people tended to have more money and build bigger houses. The black people, black families, didn't have as much money. So it would be medium-sized house, tiny house. Medium-sized house, tiny house. So we still see it. It's a neat way that architecture is telling a story for us. I'm sure that most of you know that Kentucky's history with regard to race has the unpleasantness of segregation reasserting itself. In 1904, there was a law passed that made it illegal to educate black students and white students in the same school. It was called the Day Law, after Carl Day, the legislator who proposed it and got it passed after a visit to Berea College. We were the only integrated school in the state at that point. And it appalled him to see the racist mix on the campus. And so the law was passed. We appealed that law to the various levels available to us through the Kentucky court system and all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1908, the Supreme Court found against Berea College and for the Commonwealth of Kentucky, thus legalizing the Day Law. So Berea became a segregated institution. We actually fundraised for an endowment for a school for the black students, which was located in Shelbyville. The schools had to be at least 25 miles apart, and I think it was actually located in Shelbyville to put it close to Louisville, where there would be substantial numbers of students. That the building is still there. The school itself lasted only into the 60s. It was called Lincoln Academy. It's now a Job Corps training site. You can still see the main building. Anybody know what the main building that Lincoln Institute is called? Berea Hall. So after that, we were in 1954, the law was set aside. Actually, Brown versus Board of Education was a little bit before then. And so at that point, segregationism was dead, and we reintegrated. So we have that great commitment that we want to pursue liberal arts education, but in an interracial fashion, which is very important to us because it's very much part of our history. But I will have to say, as a member of the academic leadership at Berea College, that I'm not sure even now that we completely understand what that phrase interracial education means. It certainly means that you should have people of different races involved in the community, living and learning together. And we do that without question. But that's interracial community. That by itself doesn't make it interracial education. Certainly, the experience of living with people of other cultures, and for many students from Appalachia, it might be the first time they've ever lived with an African-American student, or been close to one, and vice versa. Our students from Birmingham come from neighborhoods that are 80-90% African American, so they haven't spent much time with white students. So some education happens just in the way that
that education always happens in the residence halls. And that's definitely part of the experience at Berea College. But I think there's more to it than that. And so once again, I'm going to go for a little bit of audience participation. Beyond an interracial community, what are some of the key attributes of an education that's specifically interracial? Actually, a hard question, but Tara has a proposal. Okay, so the curriculum, the courses ought to, some of the courses anyway, ought to bear some of the cultural freight of, say, the African-American experience in the U.S. or the white experience in the U.S. or the Hispanic experience in the U.S. so that students can learn about the cultures of other people in the country. That's what you meant, something like that? Yes? That's got to be part of it. Other things?
History
I just shared a history lesson. I think it's pretty important that we understand what our state went through in that regard. And that there was one institution in 1900 that had black students and white students in the same context. And that after the segregation era ended, we were the first school that the graduates of the the high schools were segregated too, of course, at that time. And so the current generation of older black faculty members, if they happen to come from Kentucky, were all educated in single race school systems. So understanding all of that is a way of adding something very important to the experience of black students, the experience of white students, the experience of black faculty and white faculty. So definitely, the history, not only in Kentucky, but anywhere in the world where race issues have gotten complicated. Other than there.
Being self-reflexive at all times.
Okay, there's this personal identity thing that should go on, where before you take on these cultural questions, you have relatively little inclination to critically examine your own attitudes and how that might reflect what race you happen to be and how you therefore might experience or visualize a person of another race. That's the first two of these ideas, curriculum that reflects different cultural values and heritages, and history of the race question and experience. Both of those have been available at Berea College for a long time, and I suspect at most other institutions. But that critical examination of yourself, that part maybe not so much. The way I like to think about that is to observe that American higher education institutions can be divided into two categories. One is the vast majority of institutions which think of themselves, consciously or not, as white institutions that are happy to welcome people of other races and cultures. Because, first of all, it's the right thing to do, and secondly, it makes for a richer atmosphere for everybody, a more educational atmosphere. And then there's another smaller group of institutions, the historically black colleges and universities, that are, as a matter of their own identity, they're black institutions. And it's a place to go if you want to be immersed in African-American culture. So what about an institution that says, we're not either of those. We don't belong to the white race. welcoming other races. And we don't belong to the black race. We're not just a place of celebrating black life. I call that the concept of white ownership. And I think that's something we haven't thought of very much in our country. And you can ask that question at all kinds of levels. Are we a white country that welcomes people of other races? A little bit grudgingly, but we're going to do the right thing and welcome you. Is the region we live in, Appalachia, I would refer to because I'm talking about Berea, is it a white region that will tolerate black visitors and, you know, maybe a well-educated black family comes in, works in the hospital. But there are some downtowns in Appalachia where you're not even that far along, where that means if it's sundown, if you're black, you better be out of town, you know? So is the region owned by whites? And then schools. Is Berea College owned by whites but welcoming to blacks? Or is it not owned by one race or another? And that's where it gets interesting. Because for 50 years, we were owned by poor white Appalachians. That was the only mission we had left to us. In 1954, we had our first African-American students coming back, and we were recovering that earlier heritage. But it isn't until now, 50 years or so after reintegration, that we're starting to think again, trying to divorce ourselves from the attitude that at least when you boil it down to the basic essence, this is a white institution. Then I go all the way to academic disciplines. I happen to be a physicist. And although if I asked myself this question and any other white male physicist, there wouldn't be any way I could account for the fact that physics seems to be owned by white males if you ask a African-American person, or if you ask a female, they'll say, physics is owned by white males, and I'm tolerated because I'm smart and good at what I do, but I don't feel like I own this discipline, according to my identity. And then, of course, you can ask that question about your church, or whatever. Almost any organization in our culture can ask that question. I believe I've heard it said that the most segregated moment in modern American culture is 11 o'clock on Sunday morning. So churches are struggling with that same thing. So I am the conscience of the institution, so to speak, to say, let's make sure, as that questioner pointed out, that we are looking at those basic identity issues about ourselves and how that makes people of other races feel. So that was the thing I was hoping we'd get to here about our fifth grade commitment, and it applies to the sixth too, that unlike the other two institutions that I've worked substantially at, Haverford College and Colgate University, Berea College was male and female coeducational from the start. Whereas many other institutions, of course, either started as either all male or all female, and in the 70s or so, added the other gender. So that's where we are on interracial education at Berea College, and that means that we are all uncomfortable right now taking on a question like that. And besides that, there are people driving through our town with Confederate flags attached to their pickups, making us even all more uncomfortable. Question there?
I'm actually a Berea alum.
Oh, wonderful.
I was actually there the year that they started actually throwing watermelons at some black students.
What year was that?
2012, I think, was really
Speak up a little bit and tell the story.
Sometimes racial slurs thrown at you, not on campus, while acquire perspectives that students are meant to take.
Okay, we have a person with inside knowledge. What's your name, by the way?
Shana.
Shana, okay. Our liberal arts core consists of 5 required courses. The first one is a basic research and how do you access knowledge kind of course. The second one is about writing. The third one is about the Christian perspective, because we were founded by a Christian abolitionist, and we have decided to adhere to the values that Reverend John Fee espoused, even though we want to be completely inclusive when it comes to the matter of religion, so that everyone, in fact, whether you're religious or not, as long as you're willing to acknowledge that there might be a spiritual dimension to life, is welcome. The fourth course is a required course in scientific literacy, and then the fifth course is a kind of summary of the whole experience. But in addition, we have the perspectives, as Shana mentions. And the perspectives, there are 6 areas where we have identified courses in the catalog that pick up various perspectives that we want students to master. And that is another place where we look to make sure that students have that dimension of the cross-cultural experience. So great question, and that gets into the nuts and bolts. And just this week, we're being reaccredited by SACS, the dreaded on-campus visit happened this week. So we've been putting that curriculum out for everybody to see. Question there.
I think the response is as good a segue as any as far as commenting on the value of liberal arts education. There's that incongruency between what goes on within the academy and the so-called real world. I hate that term, but at the moment, that's all I can think of. To be honest with you, in the real world, just as certain as when she circulated off campus, she suffered racial attack. In the real world, there's very little respect for the real world's education, but it's always held and foregrounded on academic. But in reality, it isn't.
So I should actually be giving this talk somewhere else, right? To the extent that I can be persuasive to make sure people understand the liberal arts and might seek to have an experience of them, and of course you don't have to go to school to do it, as we pointed out. But yes, Berea College has 1,600 students and about 700 employees, which makes a little over 2,000. And our town has 14,000 people. Even in our town, we don't get to the point of the town being a good mirror for the values of the place, much less the entire world. I think that opens up a huge topic, but not one that I signed on talk about it. But I will say this, I think it does come down to education. Tell you one more story. Secretary Arne Duncan, Secretary of Education, visited Berea College because of the work we do in the school districts in the surrounding counties. That's all funded by the Department of Education through the Gear Up program, the TRIO program, and so on. It's a huge program. It has many amazing positive effects. And so I got to talk to him, and he's a good, well-educated liberal arts person. And we started talking about what is the role of government, what can Democrats and Republicans agree on. There are obviously lots that they're disagreeing on right now, but they ought to be able to agree on 2 things: that our country needs a good defense. The world is an unfriendly place, and we have to be able to take care of ourselves out there. But we also need a good offense, and a good offense is having the best education system that you can find in the world. Because the education system is what strengthens the country, makes it strong, makes it an example to other countries, and is the equivalent of an offense. So in response to that question, I think it comes down to education. If I'm disappointed about anything about Berea College is that we can only graduate about 300 to 350 students a year. There are so many more students in Kentucky, all of whom need a great education in order to be the kind of citizens that make this a good place to live for everybody. So thank you to the University of Louisville, the University of Kentucky, and the other places. You guys take on the big numbers and try to do the best you can for those students. But I think that's the answer, even though sometimes it feels like it doesn't get enough attention, and I'm worried that that will continue to be the case.
One place I saw a distinction was in technical versus non-technical, namely emphasis on chemistry and science, and then of course engineering. Now you're not opposed to engineering, so, but you're said liberal arts. But they would say, okay, we agree with mathematics and with science, but the rest of that stuff is not so valuable.
Yeah, I guess what's in the tent and what's not in the tent, that's a good question. I'm a theoretical physicist, but I sure like the bridges I drive over and the buildings that I build in not to be falling down. So I want to be surrounded by competence in engineers and doctors and all of those more skill-oriented professions. It is my sense, and I was trying to get at this with the President Cross quote about the spade and spelling book in one hand and the telescope and the Greek grammar in the other hand, that even the careers that are much more practically oriented, like being a doctor or being an engineer, I think are better pursued with the Liberal Arts Foundation. When I was at Haverford, we had a close relationship with the other Quaker schools in the Philadelphia area, one of them being Swarthmore. And Swarthmore actually had a liberal arts engineering degree, and those students had just as much exposure to the liberal arts as any other Swarthmore student. And I don't know if that makes a better engineer. I don't know how to make that argument, but I think it makes an engineer that's more satisfied with his or her life overall. So I wouldn't say anything's out of the tent, that the liberal arts can be a foundation for many forms of knowledge and many kinds of careers. And we've all encountered people who pursue a way too narrow view of what they do. And I think we see that impoverishes certainly their lives, but maybe their work eventually too. We've reached just after 7. Tracy or whoever is in charge here, should I be wrapping it up?
Probably should.
Okay. So thanks for all those great comments. I'll applaud you for your engagement as an audience. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Lumos, and thank you all for coming. And please join us at the reception.